Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and as we focus on the implications of the Russian hacking of the Democratic National Committee and analyze its impact on last year's election, let's not forget other global events that point to a disturbing trend. In Ukraine, hackers successfully shut off electricity to almost 230,000 people for 6 hours last December. The WannaCry ransomware attack briefly crippled Britain's National Health Service in May. And it wasn't just the U.S. election that was at risk this past year. On the eve of France's most consequential election in decades, or at least one of the most, the Macron campaign announced that it was the target of a massive hacking attack. So what do all these cyber attacks mean? Joining me now to discuss it is Susan Landau, former senior privacy analyst at Google, a Cybersecurity Hall of Fame inductee, who knew there was a Cybersecurity Hall of Fame, and the author now of Listening In, Cybersecurity in an Insecure Age. Professor Landau, thanks for joining us. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks very much for having me.
There's a Cybersecurity Hall of Fame?
Indeed there is. It's been in existence maybe a half dozen years now.
Who are?
It has people from the NSA, and it has people from the public sector. It has educators. It has journalists.
And you're right that several years ago, some in the U.S. military predicted a cyber Pearl Harbor, perhaps in the form of a crippling cyber attack on national infrastructure. And you go on to write, instead of attacks, we are now confronted with something that might be best described as cyber mischief. So where's the line between cyber mischief and a cyber Pearl Harbor?
So when you attack physical infrastructure, it becomes more clear that it's an attack that may lead to a strong response, a perhaps potentially physical response. If you shut down the power of a nation, if you cripple the water supply, if you cripple telecommunications. But if you attack civil society, which is what happened in the last election here and also in France, and there appears to be other attempts in Germany and other places in Europe, if you attack civil society, we don't have a good sense of what the right line is. And so our responses have been quite modest so far. I think it's a matter where the technology leaped so quickly ahead and the attempts leaped so quickly ahead that policy didn't really think about how to respond, and our responses have been weak.
And we'll get more into responses, but by way of analysis, you wrote the Russian cyber exploit against U.S. political parties and against parties in other nations demonstrates that a threat to civil society demonstrates a threat to civil society that is more difficult to combat, unquote. Is that because politicians didn't have their eye on this ball in terms of encrypting communications until now?
It's a lot of different pieces. When there's the question of ephemeral communications, so when you encrypt and you don't store the messages afterwards, and there are ways to do both storing or not storing, but if you don't store the messages afterwards, and many of our communications, we don't really want to store the messages afterwards. We make a sharp comment about somebody. We criticize the way somebody is choosing to handle a political situation. That's something we want to say in the moment, but we don't want to see it on the front page of the New York Times or the Washington Post. So choosing not to store information, choosing not to have, is one way of protecting. Another way of protecting, of course, is second factor authentication, which was not done on a number of the DNC accounts and was problematic. But another step is resilience, and that's something that the Macron campaign did. They had seeded their files with false documents so that when things were stolen, they could say, well, go ahead, publish it, but you know, some things are not correct, some things are false, and you don't know which. So there's are not thinking ahead as to what the attacks might be and not protecting against those.
And you write that the 2016 activity may be just the tip of the iceberg. This time the hacking was data theft used to embarrass and mock a presidential candidate. So what do you anticipate happening next time?
One could imagine that emails are tampered with or reports are changed. Imagine if 3 decades ago, when the American Cancer Association was publishing about the dangers of cigarette smoking, if just before they issued a report, the data was slightly tampered with in a way that they didn't really notice as the report came out and their statistics was wrong. Their reliability, the trust of the American Cancer Society reports would be greatly diminished. Imagine if a scientist was reporting on climate change and his data or her data was tampered with, and again, the report was off by 20%. It's very easy to diminish trust. It's much harder to rebuild.
My guest is Susan Landau, whose new book is Listening In, Cybersecurity in an Insecure Age. We can take your phone calls for her at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or tweet a question at Brian Lehrer. One of the interesting things in your book is you write about how cash payments are ebbing as a global trend, many businesses moving to smartphone apps that allow simple peer-to-peer payments, all of that. The MTA here in New York will transition away from the MetroCard, they say, in favor of having customers pay their fares by tapping a contactless bank card or smartphone or smart card. And I'm curious what you think some of the pros and cons of going cashless are in the cybersecurity context.
Well, in the cybersecurity context, I mean, you have to you can't separate cybersecurity from physical so easily, in the sense that one of the advantages is not carrying cash, not worrying about the toll booth, the token booths having robberies, which used to exist back when I lived in New York as a child. All sorts of problems like that disappear, but then you have other issues. What's the privacy associated with the contactless cards that people buy? How long does the MTA store the data? And if the data is connected to your phone, that's even more serious because now they have a track of where you've been. Is that available under subpoena to a divorce lawyer who then begins to track, well, you know, the husband was not going straight home. Every Tuesday and Thursday, he stopped off here and then went home. And we have instances where such data was used in cases that were not criminal but actually civil. And so issues of how long the data is stored, under what circumstances it can be accessed, how securely it's stored are really important.
North Korea has proven to be a major force in cyber potential. Everybody in the media obsesses about their nuclear potential, but the North Korean ransomware attack last May didn't make it too far stateside, but it brought down hundreds of thousands of computers across dozens of countries, including Britain's National Health Service. Last year, North Korea hackers tried stealing $1 billion from the New York Federal Reserve and were only stopped because they misspelled the word foundation. So is North Korea that good at cyber attacks?
No, I'd say we're that bad at protecting things. The ransomware attack was a very interesting situation. Microsoft updates its software when it finds security problems. The hospitals in the UK and in other places weren't able to update because they had old systems for which Microsoft wasn't issuing patches. And that's a problem with the entire ecosystem. What happens when you have systems that, when you have organizations that use old systems, perhaps because their applications on the systems can't be updated to new operating systems that Microsoft is issuing? One of the things that legislators and people in charge of organizations don't think about is paying for upkeep and maintenance of systems. They think, okay, we'll buy the computer, we're done, we don't have to do this again for 10 years. But in fact, maintenance is a really important aspect, and that piece was lost in the ransomware case. That is to say, because the systems in the UK weren't updated, because they weren't modern, they couldn't accept the patches that Microsoft issued, and so they were vulnerable. On the banking case, that was a very interesting situation. The SWIFT system for banking has been in existence for 30, 40 years. It assumed that all banks would know about authenticating themselves properly to the system. So the SWIFT system is a way that one bank in Indonesia might authorize something for the Federal Reserve to do in New York, or a bank in Switzerland might ask a bank in Belgium to do something, and they transfer money all the time. That is, they transfer it via electronic payments. But there was an assumption built into the system that every bank would securely authenticate to the system, and that wasn't true for the banks that were the targets of this. It was a mistake on the SWIFT part, the SWIFT organization, to not think about that, but it was even more a mistake of the banks to have a very weak authentication system that once it was stolen, that is, passwords were stolen, the whole system fell apart.
And sanctions have been slapped on North Korea over and over again for its nuclear program, but there hasn't been a major response to North Korea to punish them for the cyber attacks, or have I missed it?
You haven't missed it, or at least if you've missed it, I think the rest of us have as well. The problem is the normal form of retaliation might be to do something to them cyber, but they don't have much cyber, which is exactly why it's a particularly useful tool for them to use. It's also a way, with the ransomware, for them to earn some money, and I'm told that sometimes they use that money for their nuclear weaponry. It's a particularly sticky situation because our ability to put sanctions on them is really very limited. Our ability to harm North Korea is, we don't have many choices there. Other nations are not quite in the same situation, which may be why they're not acting quite as much as cyber bandits as North Korea is.
We'll continue in a minute and take your calls for Susan Landau, author of Listening In, Cybersecurity in an Insecure Age. She's a member of the Cybersecurity Hall of Fame. Where is that, by the way? It's not in Cooperstown, I assume.
No. It's near Washington, near the NSA. And it's really more of a virtual organization than a physical one, which, of course, befits cybersecurity.
Absolutely. More in a minute. Lara on WNYC, and as we focus on the implications of the Russian hacking of the Democratic National Committee and analyze its impact on last year's election, let's not forget other global events that point to a disturbing trend. In Ukraine, hackers successfully shut off electricity to almost 230,000 people for 6 hours last December. The WannaCry ransomware attack briefly crippled Britain's National Health Service in May. And it wasn't just the U.S. election that was at risk this past year. On the eve of France's most consequential election in decades, or at least one of the most, the Macron campaign announced that it was the target of a massive hacking attack. So what do all these cyber attacks mean? Joining me now to discuss it is Susan Landau, former senior privacy analyst at Google, a Cybersecurity Hall of Fame inductee. Who knew there was a Cybersecurity Hall of Fame? And the author now of Listening In, Cybersecurity in an Insecure Age. Professor Landau, thanks for joining us. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks very much for having me.
There's a Cybersecurity Hall of Fame?
Indeed there is. It's been in existence maybe a half dozen years now.
Who?
It has people from the NSA, and it has people from the public sector. It has educators. It has journalists.
And you're right that several years ago, some in the U.S. military predicted a cyber Pearl Harbor, perhaps in the form of a crippling cyber attack on national infrastructure. And you go on to write, instead of attacks, we are now confronted with something that might be best described as cyber mischief. So where's the line between cyber mischief and a cyber Pearl Harbor?
So when you attack physical infrastructure, it becomes more clear that it's an attack that may lead to a strong response, a perhaps potentially physical response. If you shut down the power of a nation, if you cripple the water supply, if you cripple telecommunications. But if you attack civil society, which is what happened in the last election here and also in France, and there appears to be other attempts in Germany and other places in Europe, if you attack civil society, we don't have a good sense of what the right line is. And so our responses have been quite modest so far. I think it's a matter where the technology leaped so quickly ahead and the attempts leaped so quickly ahead that policy didn't really think about how to respond, and our responses have been weak.
And we'll get more into responses, but by way of analysis, you wrote the Russian cyber exploit against U.S. political parties and against parties in other nations demonstrates that a threat to civil society is more difficult, sorry, demonstrates a threat to civil society that is more difficult to combat, unquote. Is that because politicians didn't have their eye on this ball in terms of encrypting communications until now?
It's a lot of different pieces. When there's the question of ephemeral communications, so when you encrypt and you don't store the messages afterwards, and there are ways to do both storing or not storing, but if you don't store the messages afterwards, and many of our communications, we don't really want to store the messages afterwards. We make a sharp comment about somebody. We criticize the way somebody is choosing to handle a political situation. That's something we want to say in the moment, but we don't want to see it on the front page of the New York Times or the Washington Post. So choosing not to store information, choosing not to have, is one way of protecting. Another way of protecting, of course, is second factor authentication, which was not done on a number of the DNC accounts and was problematic. But another step is resilience, and that's something that the Macron campaign did. They had seeded their files with false documents so that when things were stolen, they could say, well, go ahead, publish it, but you know, some things are not correct, some things are false, and you don't know which. So there's are not thinking ahead as to what the attacks might be and not protecting against those.
And you write that the 2016 activity may be just the tip of the iceberg. This time the hacking was data theft used to embarrass and mock a presidential candidate. So what do you anticipate happening next time?
One could imagine that emails are tampered with or reports are changed. Imagine if three decades ago, when the American Cancer Association was publishing about the dangers of cigarette smoking, if just before they issued a report, the data was slightly tampered with in a way that they didn't really notice as the report came out and their statistics was wrong, their reliability, the trust in the American Cancer Society reports would be greatly diminished. Imagine if a scientist was reporting on climate change and his data or her data was tampered with, and again, the report was off by 20%. It's very easy to diminish trust. It's much harder to rebuild.
My guest is Susan Landau, whose new book is Listening in, Cybersecurity in an Insecure Age. We can take your phone calls for her at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or tweet a question at Brian Lehrer. One of the interesting things in your book is you write about how cash payments are ebbing as a global trend, many businesses moving to smartphone apps that allow simple peer-to-peer payments, all of that. The MTA here in New York will transition away from the MetroCard, they say, in favor of having customers pay their fares by tapping a contactless bank card or smartphone or smart card. And I'm curious what you think some of the pros and cons of going cashless are in the cybersecurity context.
Well, in the cybersecurity context, I mean, you have to you can't separate cybersecurity from physical so easily in the sense that one of the advantages is not carrying cash, not worrying about the toll booth, the token booths having robberies, which used to exist back when I lived in New York as a child. All sorts of problems like that disappear, but then you have other issues. What's the privacy associated with the contactless cards that people buy? How long does the MTA store the data? And if the data is connected to your phone, that's even more serious because now they have a track of where you've been. Is that available under subpoena to a divorce lawyer who then begins to track, well, you know, the husband was not going straight home. Every Tuesday and Thursday, he stopped off here and then went home. And we have instances where such data was used in cases that were not criminal but actually civil. And so issues of how long the data is stored, under what circumstances it can be accessed, how securely it's stored are really important.
North Korea has proven to be a major force in cyber potential. Everybody in the media obsesses about their nuclear potential, but the North Korean ransomware attack last May didn't make it too far stateside, but it brought down hundreds of thousands of computers across dozens of countries, including Britain's National Health Service. Last year, North Korea hackers tried stealing $1 billion from the New York Federal Reserve and were only stopped because they misspelled the word foundation. So is North Korea that good at cyber attacks?
No, I'd say we're that bad at protecting things. The ransomware attack was a very interesting situation. Microsoft updates its software when it finds security problems. The hospitals in the UK and in other places weren't able to update because they had old systems for which Microsoft wasn't issuing patches. And that's a problem with the entire ecosystem. What happens when you have systems that, when you have organizations that use old systems, perhaps because their applications on the systems can't be updated to new operating systems that Microsoft is issuing? One of the things that legislators and people in charge of organizations don't think about is paying for upkeep and maintenance of systems. They think, okay, we'll buy the computer, we're done, we don't have to do this again for 10 years. But in fact, maintenance is a really important aspect, and that piece was lost in the ransomware case. That is to say, because the systems in the UK weren't updated, because they weren't modern, they couldn't accept the patches that Microsoft issued, and so they were vulnerable. On the banking case, that was a very interesting situation. The SWIFT system for banking has been in existence for 30, 40 years. It assumed that all banks would know about authenticating themselves properly to the system. So the SWIFT system is a way that one bank in Indonesia might authorize something for the Federal Reserve to do in New York, or a bank in Switzerland might ask a bank in Belgium to do something. They transfer money all the time. That is, they transfer it via electronic payments. But there was an assumption built into the system that every bank would securely authenticate to the system, and that wasn't true for the banks that were the targets of this. It was a mistake on the SWIFT part, the SWIFT organization, to not think about that, but it was even more a mistake of the banks to have a very weak authentication system that once it was stolen, that is, passwords were stolen, the whole system fell apart.
And sanctions have been slapped on North Korea over and over again for its nuclear program, but there hasn't been a major response to North Korea to punish them for the cyber attacks, or have I missed it?
You haven't missed it, or at least if you've missed it, I think the rest of us have as well. The problem is the normal form of retaliation might be to do something to them cyber, but they don't have much cyber, which is exactly why it's a particularly useful tool for them to use. It's also a way, with the ransomware, for them to earn some money, and I'm told that sometimes they use that money for their nuclear weaponry. It's a particularly sticky situation because our ability to put sanctions on them is really very limited. Our ability to harm North Korea is, we don't have many choices there. Other nations are not quite in the same situation, which may be why they're not acting quite as much as cyber bandits as North Korea is.
We'll continue in a minute and take your calls for Susan Landau, author of Listening In, Cybersecurity in an Insecure Age. She's a member of the Cybersecurity Hall of Fame. Where is that, by the way? It's not in Cooperstown, I assume.
No. It's near Washington, near the NSA. And it's really more of a virtual organization than a physical one, which, of course, befits cybersecurity.
Absolutely. More in a minute.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, a refugee remembers the city of Aleppo, Syria, as it was in the old days.
Aleppo is a 24-hour city, so you can go out and eat the sandwiches even 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock, it's okay.
It's a story of war and memory and Aleppo's famous lamb brain sandwich.
When you hear it, it's weird, but when you eat it, it's delicious.
That's next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour. Tomorrow morning at 10 on 93.9 FM, WNYC.
WNYC supporters include the Mount Sinai National Jewish Health Respiratory Institute. The Respiratory Institute is dedicated to using advanced therapies and specialized care to help New Yorkers breathe easier. More at therespiratoryinstitute.org. Cohen Media Group, presenting a new 2K restoration of the Merchant Ivory film Shakespeare Walla. A romantic drama starring Mahdhur Jaffrey and Shashi Kapoor starts today at Quad Cinemas. WNYC is a media partner of Brooklyn Flea, with a new indoor market in Soho, with 60 vendors selling vintage, design, and more. Open every Saturday and Sunday year-round at 100 Avenue of the Americas, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Info at brooklynflea.com.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Susan Landau, author of Listening In, Cybersecurity in an Insecure Age, and John in Caldwell. You're on WNYC. Hi, John.
Hi, can you hear me?
Sure can.
Hi, thank you so much. I'm teaching a class on just war theory at Fordham University right now, and this question's coming up. Whether we ought to start considering conventional responses to the most serious forms of cyber attack, if they're on our political system, or things like hospitals or other vital pieces of infrastructure, maybe we should start to have a policy that says, well, you know, we're going to hit an unmanned facility first, maybe take out some planes when no one's in them. And if this continues, we're going to sink a ship or two. I mean, I think this is what Reagan would have done. I honestly don't think that any number of patches or improvements to our security systems is going to stop Russia, North Korea, China from doing this without some kind of strong deterrent. So that's my question for Ms. Landau.
I absolutely agree that we need strong deterrence. And the question is exactly what flavor. So it could be, of course, a cyber attack that does something without necessarily having our fingerprints on it, but the other side will know. It could also be, of course, a physical kinetic attack. I do think that the seriousness of the attack on the campaign, what in the U.S. campaign, the French campaign, does raise the level from, I call it mischief in the book, but of course it is much more than mischief. It warrants a serious response, and the sanctions we put on a few Russians do not befit the seriousness of the attack.
Sean on Staten Island, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Brian. I actually want to do a follow-up on what John just said, because my concerns somewhat mirror his own. I work in IT, and we tend to that in placing usually the most vulnerable, kind of places that don't have any sort of redundancy whatsoever. Rather than just a deterrent, deterrent is not really going to make much of a difference if we have an infrastructure compromise, such as a power grid coming offline for an indeterminate amount of time. So I was wondering, what steps can we actually take to waylay that? And are those steps currently being taken by any sort of administration that we know of?
So what you're really talking here is about resilience. And resilience is incredibly important. I do know that after the attack on the Ukraine system, so the Ukraine power grid, there were three power distribution centers in western Ukraine that were taken offline within a half hour of each other. The attack was extremely sophisticated. The attackers had gone in 6 months before through a business network, and from there got to the distribution network because there wasn't good authentication between the two systems. And although the three distribution networks were differently architected, that is, they worked somewhat differently, the attackers were able to bring all three down within a half hour of each other. That bespeaks a great deal of sophisticated expertise on the side of the attackers. They probably had a lab in which they mimicked what existed on the distribution systems. Ukraine was able to bring up the systems within 6 hours because a lot of it had physical components rather than electronic. That is, they were still physically controlled, and they could the power grid workers could actually go and turn things back on. I know that the U.S. government, or not the U.S. government, but the people who work in the power grid are now taking that lesson very much to heart. And going from reliability, which used to be the way we talked about the power grid, they're now talking about resilience. Other organizations have to think really hard about what resilience means. For some organizations, resilience might mean protecting the data they own. So, for example, if you go to the Sony attack, the attack of the North Koreans on Sony Picture Entertainment, there, for some reason, Sony had its movies accessible very easily. Those should not have been on a system that was easy to get to. Resilience says you put them somewhere else. resilience is going to vary with the type of organization you are. A hospital needs a different type of resilience than the power grid needs a different type of resilience than financial centers. But resilience is the direction we have to go. There is some work in the Department of Homeland Security on this, but I don't think the private sector has thought nearly as much about it as they ought.
Can I ask you about Google in that respect, since you used to be a senior privacy analyst at Google, and now there's so much focus on, you know, these tech giants, Google and Twitter and Facebook, with respect to the Russian hacking. I think more Twitter and Facebook in that particular case, but Google to some degree. Since Google is practically, it's not regulated as a public utility, but it's so universally used, it's practically like a public utility. What's Google's responsibility here, in your opinion, and how good are they at it?
So there are many pieces to that question. We could take a couple of days to answer it. And I also want to be careful because I can only talk about some things about Google. Mm-hmm. But the first part is I want to say that while I was at Google and since I've been at Google, I continue to be impressed with the quality of their security. The way Google works is they have people's data. They lose trust of the public if their security isn't good. And since the attacks of the Chinese back in 2010, they've really worked very hard on their security, and I think they do a really good job. That's a different question from how should they respond to when, for example, a lot of Twitter bots or ads start all of a sudden promoting fake news. And because of the way they use machine learning to sort what comes up at the top of a search, they're suddenly prone to promoting something that isn't accurate. And I think for all these companies, for Facebook and Google in particular, because of the way data is provided to the public, they have to rethink the extent to which they use automated tools and the extent to which they actually involve humans. And some of this is extremely complicated. You can say, yes, an ad for Trump, an ad for Clinton, an ad for a freeholder, as in the previous section, all of those are political ads and should be labeled as political ads. But there was a situation in Germany a couple of years ago in which all of a sudden there was a lot of news about Muslims attacking a Russian-German teenager who had run away from home. It turned out that this was completely fake news. There had been no such attack. She had run away from home. She made it up, or the Russian bots and Russian propaganda made it up. That piece of information in and of itself is not a political ad, but of course it affects politics very strongly. Now, how do you take information like that and label it and discover it and show to people that that is not, one, it's not real, but two, observe that it's behaving like politics? And that, I think, is both complicated technically, but also complicated in terms of what we think about as First Amendment issues.
How much do you think disclosure requirements would help solve that problem? In other words, if there's an ad on regular broadcast radio or TV that's for a candidate in a campaign, the source of the funding has to be disclosed, not so online.
Oh, that one's an easy answer. Of course you should disclose it online. There should be no difference between online and broadcast medium. The question is, on the radio, many stations do not promote this type of fake news. But what happens when you have some fake claim that starts being broadcast all across Twitter or Facebook or Google? How do you recognize it as fake, and how do you label it? And it's harder there because there is no source of control. So on your direct question, of course, the internet companies should be required to label political ads. That seems completely clear.
Let's see if we can sneak in one quick question and quick answer. Margaret in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Margaret, can you do it in 15 seconds?
I certainly am. I've been finding an abundance of ads popping up, very specific ads based on conversations that I have in a room. I am convinced that my iPhone is picking up these conversations. The other day, my daughter did a test randomly. She asked, did you happen to get an ad for Ziploc bags, which I rarely use, by the way? I said, you know, oh my God, yes, I did. I noticed one on Facebook. I thought it was odd since I don't usually buy these things. She said, I did a test. I just started talking about it.
And I have to leave it there because the show's just about over, but do you get what she's getting at, and can you address it?
I get what she's getting at. So I do not have my microphones on. I don't have an Alexa or Echo, and I have no interest in doing so. The IoT device I'll use, if I use one, will be a camera outside my house to see who's trying to get in, but not something inside. I don't believe the technology does that. But of course, because I'm not inside the companies, I can't tell you for sure.
And who knows what it will do tomorrow. Susan Landau teaches at Tufts and is the author now of Listening In, Cybersecurity in an Insecure Age. This was really interesting. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And have a great weekend, everyone. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.